format on the bulletin. If you want an up-to-date list of current, that's redundant. And if you want an up-to-date list of responsibilities, the this morning's bulletin has on the back current responsibility for 1980 with everybody's phone number on there. So you might take that home and pack it up, and maybe it'll remind you to pray for somebody. Maybe it'll remind you to fuss at somebody. So whatever the case is, we want you to utilize that. We've been talking on Sunday nights about some aspects of civil justice in the Bible in view of some current events, things that are happening in the United States. And tonight I'm not going to do an exegesis of a passage. I'm just going to try to come at you with some concepts of the relationship of church and state historically, and some of the things, some of the trends that we're having today. In order to do this, I've sort of sketched out a twofold scenario, and I'd like to throw this on the overhead, but I realize I can't list all the points. I want you to picture a twofold scenario, will you? And on the right-hand column, I'm going to list some aspects of state churchism. Okay? Now, state churchism can be reduced to the concept of government sponsorship of religion. Government sponsorship of religion. And whenever you have a state church, you have one church that is selected to represent the religious emphasis of that state. This was the case in England. This was the case in Germany. There was no Germany in the various states of Germany before 1870. It's the case of Italy, Spain, etc. This was also the case of Massachusetts Bay Colony. It was also the case of Virginia eventually, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, New York eventually in time, etc. There was a state church. Now, whenever you have a state church, then you have a control agency. And a control agency is generally some form of Department of Religious Affairs, something to that effect, okay? A bureau. And you have a bureaucracy in the state. And that bureaucracy then is the responsible agency in terms of intercommunication between religion and the state and state and religion. It's a clearinghouse. Okay, you also have economic support, and wherever you have economic support, that is also a means of control. So we have to list also control. Okay? In other words, the pastors or the religious leaders, if they're in temples or pastors, whatever they are in a situation like that, are state employees. They are responsible in terms of a certain line of communication or a line of ladder of authority to the state. And one of the debilitating factors of the church in Europe, and I think this is readily admitted by everybody, is this issue of pastors being on state payrolls, okay? You have also then the concept of regulation that comes under this control agency. You have regulation and authorization. In other words, they authorize who will be considered to be aspect of the church, state, and so on, and then they will regulate that, okay? And as we said, pastors or leaders, religious leaders, whatever you want to call them, are state employees. Okay? It's almost like a form of perpetual social security for the pastor. Now, that is one scenario that we diagram. And we said that was the case of Europe and a number of the colonies in early America. Now, on this other side, I'm going to draw a totally different thing, but I want you to see the results of both of these. Over here, we're going to diagram secular statism. Secular statism. Now, what is secular statism? This means that you have a certain tolerance and a certain intolerance of government toward religion. Okay? and the government defines the guidelines or the tolerance levels, what they will tolerate in terms of religious expression. So secular statism is a form of government tolerance of religion. And again, it will be the government who will say what they will tolerate and what they will not. Now I'm going to read 8 points to you. If you're interested in these points afterward, I'll let you have my notes. Maybe you can take them in shorthand, or maybe you can write them in your form of shorthand. I'm going to read 8 of these to you, okay? Number 1, no propagation of religion to youth under 18. These are practical manifestations of secular statism. No propagation, number 1, of religion to youth under 18. Number 2, no propagation of religion to government cadres, whatever form the government cadre takes. If it's some workers in the field, you do not propagate religion to them. They are not authorized, the government cadre is not authorized to believe in religion. So government says we will not tolerate anyone taking religion to the cadre. Number 3, religious activities are permitted only in churches or temples approved for such meetings. If you are a citizen of this state and you decide you would like to have a little informal gathering and talk about religion, you go to the bureau first and you get permission to have a meeting. Or maybe they won't tolerate that. Maybe you won't get the permission. Number 4, religion is not to be propagated outside the churches and the temples. If you do have a bureaucratic sanction to have a meeting, you have to, whatever you're going to say, you keep it confined to your meeting place and the hours you're permitted to meet. Number 5, no contact with religious organizations outside the state. Number 6, no acceptance of financial aid from any foreign organizations. Number 7, no regulation or no religious meetings are permitted in homes. Sort of an addendum to number 4. Number 9. Now listen to this one. Listen to this one. Speeches, catechisms, religious education materials must be first approved by the Religious Affairs Bureau before they can be publicized. Okay? Now does anybody know what I just read to you? Pardon? No, does anybody know what these 8 regulations are? No, they're from China. These are 8 regulations that have been recently published in China by the Religious Affairs Bureau of China, because they are now going to sanction the reopening of the churches in China. And these are the published guidelines for reopening churches in China. In other words, there are still congregations in China who take the tag Christian, and they want to reopen their churches. These are 8 guidelines. They are very current, very recent, relative to the opening of those churches. Okay? This is secular statism. This is a state expressing what it will tolerate and what it will not tolerate relative to religion. Now, in both of these, you see, in both of these cases, both of these scenarios that I've pictured to you. One, you have the right, extreme right. You have the state church. And on the left, you have a state that is totally divorced, in a sense, from the church, except that it controls what the church can propagate and what it can do. So in both, you see, what I'm trying to show you is, in both, the church or religion, the church or religion is controlled by the state. Okay? And in essence, in effect, what happens under both of those systems is that the church becomes meaningless in everyday life. In other words, you have separation of church and life, essentially, under both of those systems. Now, this one, The effects of state churchism can be documented historically because it is a phenomenon that happened in Europe both before the Reformation and after the Reformation. And the evils of it and the weaknesses of it and the parallelism of it, how it paralyzes a church, very simple to document that. But what was beautiful was that in the United States, and this is my approach to American church history, you have an experiment. You have an experiment in freedom of religion, which you don't have under either of these systems. Okay? Now, I'm not pushing panic buttons or anything, and I don't want you to think that in that regard, but let me read you some things that have happened just recently in the United States. Relative to some of these issues that we're talking about. This is from Friday's Denver Post Religious Confusion section. And it speaks of a Texas school district, the article I'm reading, stopping Bible distribution. The Arlington School District in Arlington, Texas, Arlington is right between Dallas and Fort Worth. In fact, that's one huge megapolis down there now. Has ended its 14-year policy of letting free Bibles be distributed to students. Superintendent Woodrow Counts said the U.S. Supreme Court rulings indicate the Bible giveaways would be declared unconstitutional. They haven't been, that hasn't been done yet, but he says it's going to happen. So at the Board of Trustees meeting and so on, they said they would stop the distribution of Bible. The district is committed to the constitutional principle of separation in church and state. The school district will neither advance nor inhibit religion. Bibles have been given in a voluntary basis by Gideon's International, but they will no longer be permitted to do this. The policy change was in request to was in response to a request by the American Civil Liberties Union, as you would probably expect. Here's another example. This is in a communique relative to some issues current in church and state relationships. A federal judge in Missouri barred an officially recognized Christian campus organization called Cornerstone, I do not know the organization, from meeting on the campus because it would have the primary effect of advancing religion at the state-owned university of Missouri. The same action is being taken place in Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington. Now, for a long time, it would be virtually impossible for me as a pastor to go on the DU campus and sort of voluntary witness to somebody as a pastor or as a representative of this church, or to go visiting somebody in the dormitories. I have to get permission from that. The school could not give permission to that. There has to be some officially recognized bureaucratic organization that puts the stamp of approval on me, and it would be very hard for me to get that. At CU on orientation day, they have a religious section. And if you want to apply for a seat at the religious section, if you're a pastor, you can do that. See, and you sort of set up your little booth and bring in your gimmicks to try to attract the students to your organization. But you can't go on the campus. I'm not opposed to that. I'm just telling you something that's going on. Here's another interesting situation. Listen to this. In Los Angeles, the City Department of Building and Safety has used zoning laws to prohibit Bible studies in private homes in neighborhoods not zoned for, quote, church purposes. We're quoting now. It will be the department's policy to issue cease and desist orders against any religious meeting in a private home not zoned for church use. City building inspectors told Christians wanting to have Bible studies in their home that they should, quote, get a permit from the city before an individual has a Bible study in their home. And according to this statement, they can't get the permit for in the home unless they are zoned for a church area. So on the basis of zoning, you see, the city could say, no, you can't have a Bible study in your home. Those are not good That is not good news in terms of liberty in the United States. Yes, Bert. No, I don't. That's my initial confrontation with the statement. I haven't seen it in the paper or anything to that effect. I haven't the slightest idea. I do with the Texas thing. And I'll maybe say something about that later, but I don't with that particular issue. There are two prominent groups that are pushing the legal and the law aspects of this issue of that we're talking about. The one is the American Civil Liberties Union, of course, and it has been doing that for some time. And all Christians who are knowledgeable sort of hate the American Civil Liberties Union. And then there's Madeline Murray. Is her last name O'Hare now? Is that right? Do I have that right? Madeline Murray O'Hare, is that right? She married a guy named O'Hare. I'm pretty sure. When I first had contact with her, she was just Madeline Murray, but I think it's Madeline Murray O'Hare. And she has quite a organization behind her now of atheists. They claim to be atheists. Although it's hard for me to believe that that's true, because in certain recent reports, there's only supposed to be 4% of people in the United States that are atheists. But she has a lot of money behind her. And so she is pushing a number of court issues, legal issues, like get the In God We Trust off the coins, etc. Whatever the case, in a number of these, whoever's pushing the legislation for some of these things, they are doing it largely, or in many cases, on the basis of the First Amendment, which is essentially the establishment clause of the Constitution of the United States. Now, all of you know that, well, maybe you don't know, let me remind you, I'm sure you know, it's just a matter of reminding, that one of the things that the founders of this country were fearful of was the abuse of governmental power. And so the purpose of the Constitution of the United States was, one of the purposes, was to limit the capacity of government to abuse its citizens. And so they set up this sort of a three-divisional aspect of government, the legislature, the executive, and the judicial, so that no one group could accrue to itself too much power. And there's a matter of checks and balances then within the Constitution. So there was a limitation both of size of government and function of government in the Constitution, purposely designed that way so that the citizens would not be abused. Then to make certain that the rights of the citizen would not just be assumed, the rights of the citizens were defined in the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. And the First Amendment of the Constitution is called the Establishment Clause, and it reads this way: Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Okay. This is sometimes called the Establishment Clause or the Free Exercise Clause. And like I said before, the United States is an experiment. The United States is an experiment in religious liberty. And the people in this country in 1789 were ready for that experiment. They had seen, they had experienced the abuses of the state church in Europe, and some of them had experienced the abuses of the state church in the United States. And they were saying, we must have freedom of religion in order to express ourselves. And then, see, we had to define what freedom of religion is, and then it had to be defined under law. What is freedom of religion? For example, along the way, the Mormons are going to come along in 1862, and there's a man that's going to take a case. Well, he's not going to take it. It's going to get to the Supreme Court eventually, but Congress is going to have to enact a law, an anti-bigamy law. because this man said that under freedom of religion, he should have plurality of law, of wives, that this was a part of his religion. And interestingly, the Mormon Church didn't change that stature or that position. They continued to teach that bigamy was a biblical position until the Supreme Court test came. And the Supreme Court test simply ruled it out. The Chief Justice said that, and he wrote the prevailing opinion, and he said that marriage is a civil contract regulated by law, and upon it society is built, and out of its fruit springs social obligations and duties in which government is required to deal. And a multiplicity of wives would upset that social system. And so it was ruled out by the Supreme Court's test, Reynolds versus United States in 1874. What is freedom of religion? You see. Moreover, the experiment with the issue of what does the First Amendment mean? And you see, I think it was Justice Holmes in 1931 or 32 in there said that the Constitution of the United States is the supreme law of the land, but it is the Supreme Court that tells the land what the Constitution says. In other words, we interpret what the Constitution means, and that is what becomes the law of the land. Okay? Now, what I would like to do is to show you, give you some objective evidence of what the Establishment Clause meant when the Constitution was founded and what it did not mean. Okay? And in order to do that, I want to sort of draw a little diagram on the overhead. Okay? And the purpose of this diagram is to and I don't know how much I can get on this overhead, but it's to sort of illustrate the problem and then the experiment and some of the unfolding of it. Okay? Separation of church and state in the United States. Okay? First of all, it doesn't come until 1789, and even then it is not finalized. So in our chart, somewhere on the way, we are coming to this moment of finality or moment of crystallized attitude or expression, and it comes in the Bill of Rights, 1789. I'm going to have to change this plug. It's right where my foot hits it. So 1789, we have the Bill of Rights. And in the Bill of Rights, and we'll put this as a timeline, we have Article 1. This is exciting to me. This was proposed by James Madison. It had already been approved earlier in the state legislature in Virginia. They had already outlawed a state church, and they had granted freedom of religion to everyone in Virginia. And that's exciting to me because my ancestors were supposed to have been in Virginia. I don't know if it's true or not. And they were wealthy. They were landowners. They had come from England, where they were supposed to be friends of Norman the Conqueror, having originated in France. And they were associated with him as the Marmon, his Marmon. And when they went to England, he granted, supposedly an ancestor of mine, a large tract of land, and these Marmon became Merrymen, spelled with an I. And then one of my ancestors and his family moved to Virginia, bought a large portion of land, and changed the spelling to a Y. And when Virginia, in the 1600s, established the Anglican Church around 1680, my ancestor said, "We will not pay our taxes to the Anglican Church. We do not want to support the Anglican Church. We are not Anglicans. We'll sell all our property and we'll move." And they moved to Baltimore and lived with the Catholics, where there was no state church. Well, it was a number of men from Virginia that really pushed this Article 1 of the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause. Okay. And one thing that that Establishment Clause definitely was to do was to prevent the establishment of any national church in this country, regardless of what name you put on the church. Okay? Now, up until that time, okay, if we were to draw a map of the coast of the United States, and this will be a rough one, that's supposed to be swooping over there to New York and so on, Delaware, etc., swing down here, Georgia and Florida, and we were to divide the colonies. These are the Great Lakes. Sort of like this, into three parts. North, middle, south. In general, we could say this about the colonies. In the north, you had a church that controlled the state. And what church was that? No. The only part of that was Church of England was New York. Congregational. It was a congregational church. It was the Puritan setup. And if you were not a member of the church, you could not vote. And certainly you couldn't be an elected officer of the community. A lot of things that the Puritans gave us, their legacy, is really worthwhile, and it's what built this country. And I certainly don't want to be considered in those that are Puritan knockers or those that are practiced the Puritan put down. I'm for the Puritan put up. Now, many of the things that the Puritans built and did in this country still exist in terms of physical things because they were so interested, or they were so involved in their work and the work ethic and the Protestant work ethic, and they left a lot of good. But one of the things that they were trying was an experiment in theocracy. Now, the Puritans did not have room for a pluralistic society in their mentality, which America was destined to become. And they're going to run into trouble early. The Puritan concept of freedom religion was this, quote, "The Baptists, the Quakers, the Catholics have no free liberty, or have the free liberty to keep away from Massachusetts Bay Colony. We will not tolerate them in this colony." And 1631, they have to kick one of their own pastors out, who was pastor of Salem Congregational Church. Roger Williams is kicked out. Anne Hutchison has to leave. And then in 1658, woe and behold, the Quakers come in. And by then you're in second generation Puritans. And boy, they have to banish the Quakers under the threat of death. And when some of the Quakers, who were the rebel hippie types of that day, would not leave or came back the next year, where they were hung to the giant elm tree gallows in Boston, the famous Robinson Stevenson, Marmaduke and Mary Dyer case. So in New England, no freedom of religion, because they were the new Israel. And in the Old Testament, no freedom of religion. Don't ever get that idea. And because the Puritans were trying to build a theocracy, they took their defense on Old Testament passages. In the middle colonies, essentially, this is what you have. You have civic privileges for believers in God. Now, that is not exactly religious liberty. For example, Lord Baltimore, who was a Catholic, and coming from this into this country, Lord Calvert, Lord Baltimore, you couldn't make Catholicism an established church in this country. You couldn't survive. So what he had was essentially freedom of religion, except for Jews and anti-Trinitarians. If you were a Unitarian, you dare not go to Baltimore, or you dare not go to Maryland Colony. It was only for Trinitarians. Okay? In Pennsylvania was probably the most liberal, the most generous of all of the early colonies in terms of freedom of religion. But I think you would find it would be very hard to hold civic office in Pennsylvania in the colonial period if you were a Jew or an atheist. You'd never make it in the civil office. Okay? In the South, you had a state-controlled church. The Episcopal Church became established in Virginia and in North Carolina and in South Carolina and in Georgia. And the political system, the vestry system, was such that it was conducive for the vestry officials to control the church officials. Where in New England, the pastors were such powerful forces in the community that they controlled the state. Okay? Okay. Now, when the Constitution came to be drafted, they had very, very little trouble passing the First Amendment or any of the amendments to the Constitution. And as I said, the citizens of this country were ready for an experiment. They had nothing to base it on historically, because historically there had never been freedom of religion anywhere. And so they drafted this clause. Okay? Now I want to show you some of the things that meant at that time, and I think you'll recognize these immediately. Okay? What did this Establishment Clause mean at that time? It meant. I'm going to list a number of things because I think it's important that you know this. And here's the reason I think it's important. It's important because this is the clause that is being used to push the United States toward secular statism in our day. And I think you're going to find it's going to be tougher and tougher as time goes on. There is tremendous assault, for example, by the federal government and the bureaucracies of the federal government on the private school sector, Christian schools in this country. They're trying to force upon them legislation relative to hiring practices that would destroy their very system. And one of the reasons that this is happening is that the private school, the Christian school movement in the United States is exploding. And the state schools are threatened by that, you see. So there is tremendous assault in a number of areas. Okay. The first thing that this meant was that it forbade, or it, in a practical way, it forbade, it didn't say that, but it did forbid, it forbade a national church. Now, by a national church, what we mean is the establishment of any one church as the recognized church to be supported by the government in the United States, as per the Anglican churches in England, which is still the national state church, as per Lutheranism in West Germany, which is still the state church. In Denmark, you still have a state church. Or do you? Maybe you don't in Denmark. In Holland, the Reformed Church became the state church. This outlawed or forbade or stopped that from ever happening. Okay? And this thing that went on in Denver at Christmas time, I just wanted to do some calling because it seemed that there was a lot of false information, and certainly there was a lot of historical information. It was totally in error. This did not forbid, however, states to have state churches. Do you know that? Now that seems like an inconsistency, doesn't it? Five states still maintain state churches. All this did was outlaw state churches on the national level. And I never heard it once said on all of that furor that went on these talk shows before Christmas. But Massachusetts had a state church until 1833. They are the last one to have a state church. New Hampshire and Vermont still have a state church 1817, 1818. But Massachusetts goes all the way to 1833. It is true that I think after the 14th Amendment, after the 14th Amendment, the legislature said that all the amendments and all the aspects of the amendments of the Constitution apply to all the states equally. and they did. But that was much later in terms of time. Okay? Okay. This did not mean separation. The Establishment Clause, or the first Article 1 of the Constitution, or the Bill of Rights, did not mean separation of state and God. It did not mean separation of state and God. How do we know it did not mean separation of state and God? Well, we know that it didn't mean that because, number one, both houses of the legislature and the Supreme Court had chaplains and opened daily in prayer, and as far as I know, they still do. Number two, we know it did not mean separation of state and God because coins were minted with the inscription, "In God We Trust," on them. Number three, we know it did not mean separation of state and God because chaplains were assigned to the military, which was supported by the government. Okay? We know it did not mean separation of state and God because certain of the states continued to have state churches. And there was no furor raised in the federal government relative to that issue. Okay? Okay. Most interpretations of the meaning of Article 1 followed Madison and Jefferson, both of whom were from Virginia and had already been through this battle in the House of Burgesses in Virginia. Okay? Okay, and the concept there was the concept of a wall separating church sponsorship, or state sponsorship, fiscally, any other way, of any one or many churches. And they would lump that all in with the idea of religion. Okay? Okay, any questions on that up to that point? Yes, question.
By 1789, were there any groups left in the United States that were actually pursuing the idea of a theocracy?
No. It had proven so impractical. See, the issue of a theocracy is that you have a forced religion. And you cannot tolerate any threat to that forced religion. Now, that is a very impractical thing. It does not work in terms of practice. A theocracy has to be based on regeneration, like Israel was based on regeneration. If regeneration doesn't work, the theocracy won't work. Israel is an example of that, see? And Israel is a theocracy that was designed by God. He called them into existence. He makes a contract with them. No way could anybody establish that was happening in history. But the Puritans felt that way in their mind. That was their think in terms of their calling by God. And they called New England the New Israel. See, they looked upon themselves as a theocracy. But by 1789, it was obvious that America was a pluralistic society. Okay? And that freedom of conscience was a liberty that was not only to be preserved, it was to be cultivated and encouraged. You see? A very, very healthy concept. And so the Bill of Rights was to, the First Amendment was also to ensure the capacity and the ongoing of freedom of conscience. You had much of that, much expression relative to that during the Revolutionary War because of the issue of England. Any other question? Yeah?
There's something else that comes out of this when you start arguing about Eastern religion in the United States, and that's that these guys, as some will argue, were unaware of even the idea of people not believing in God's day, that even Jews believe in God.
Right, every day,
people are arguing for a broadening of the interpretation of this amendment on the basis of understanding that you're not obligated to believe in God, these people believe in, that you can have some other
That's freedom of conscience. Yes, that would be a modern expression of freedom of conscience. And I think that might be an expression of freedom of conscience, perhaps by Jefferson, and maybe Madison, and maybe Benjamin Franklin. Maybe not so much the expression of some of the other founding fathers of the United States. Well, we have to deal with that, though.
You're saying then that possibly it's all beyond the belief in God that determines what is religion.
Yes, some of them. Not beyond that. But they might have some pretty generous attitude about the expression of God. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Now, in time, you see, in time, this would have to be tested. In fact, the entire Constitution of the United States would have to be tested in time as to what it means specifically. And it's still being tested, isn't it? I mentioned, for example, the anti-bigamy case relative to the Mormons. That was one test of what freedom of conscience and freedom of religion meant. There was another case relative to Seventh-day Adventism that went all the way to the Supreme Court, that Seventh-day Adventists felt that it was a violation of their religious privileges to have to work on their Sabbath. And they took it to the Supreme Court, and they won. There was another test in, I think it was 1962, a test case which I think has been terribly perverted in terms of what it means, and that is the prayer case of the New York Regents, which was not an outlawing of prayer in public school. It was an outlawing of anybody writing a prayer that was supposed to be prayed in the public schools orally. In other words, the New York Regents had written a prayer and says, we approve of this prayer being read in the schools. And the prayer wasn't even Christian, because it wasn't even in the name of Jesus Christ. And what the Supreme Court outlawed was that nobody has the right to write a prayer that will become a standardized prayer for anybody in the United States. And what happens when that filters down often to the grade school teacher? Now listen to me. The grade school teacher says we can't constitutionally pray in public schools. That is not what they outlawed at all. And now, I think it's New Hampshire right now, this last week in New Hampshire, they have okayed Bible reading and prayer in the schools. And now the American Civil Liberties Union is protesting that, and that'll probably go to the Supreme Court too. That case will probably go all the way, because they started it up again. The 1962 case, I'm pretty sure that's the year, the New York Regents case, did not cover what many people thought it covered. Misunderstanding. This is being tested, you see. The Bill of Rights is being tested, what it means. Okay. What can we do about this? What is to be our attitude? We see secular humanism making such inroads in the 20th century in the United States. We can see secular humanism forcing the state to divorce itself of any identity with God. And when you do that, you have no absolutes in morality. We can see secular humanism in its various arms, the Madeleine Murray O'Hare concept, the American Civil Liberties Union concept. To them, separation of church and state means separation of God and state. And we know that that was not the meaning of the drafters of the Constitution. I think that one of the things that we are experiencing is the same battle perhaps that the Puritans experienced. And that was the problem of the responsibility of a righteous man, a justified man to society. And that's a struggle. And the Puritan concept was them down the wrong road. What is the role of the Christian relative to the influence, to influencing the state laws in a pluralistic society? What is our role? All right, I'm going to give you some points, and I'm just going to dictate them because I think these are obvious to all of you. And yet at the same time, I think it's something you're going to have to struggle with in the days ahead, and maybe you can come back at me. I'd be glad to have you do that. I'd like some feedback. What is the role of a Christian relative to influencing the state laws in a pluralistic society? Remember that. We have a pluralistic society. We cannot get myopic. The majority of the society is Christian. Do you know that? Henry Morse has an article in the new Acts and Facts. It hasn't come yet. I get advanced copies of this. And there was a Gallup poll that was conducted. And, it was commissioned by Christianity Today. And it's, I don't get that magazine anymore. When Kenneth Cancer took over, I had it up as far as I can go, so I don't get it. But anyhow, I guess it was reported there, and I'm sorry, I didn't notice that when I read this. But anyhow, there was a Gallup poll taken, of approximately 155 million Americans, 18 or older. No less than one half believe God created Adam and Eve to start the human race. Boy, that's a surprise to me. Okay, out of the 155 million, 31 million, 20% consider themselves evangelicals. And of this group, Dr. Gallup says they believe by almost 8-to-1 margin that God created Adam and Eve to start human life. This Gallup poll found that 70% of all adult Americans still believe in God. Only 4% are explicitly atheistic. More than 80% believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God in a unique sense. I don't know what that means. And more than 40% believe the Bible to be the inerrant Word of God. That's good news. Furthermore, 80% of all Americans, including practically all evangelicals, believe the Ten Commandments are still valid today, except you take one of them and transfer it to Sunday. That doesn't say that in here, but that's what people believe. So that the widespread propaganda for the new morality has not been successful after all, which is Dr. Morris's interpretation. And that's, I don't know where all these people are, but that's good news if that's true. Now, what is the role of a... Regardless of that, we live in a pluralistic society. Now, what is the role of the Christian relative to influencing state laws in a pluralistic society? One, Christians are to be actively involved in the affairs and the functions of state. In other words, we have sought to show in this issue of civil justice in the Bible that Christians are not to isolate or separate themselves from the process. Number two, however, we are not to seek to make Christianity the religion of the state, nor to seek the state's support in terms of our expressions of Christianity. We're not to do that. You will never find in the Pauline epistles or in the expressions of the New Testament, whether they are the general epistles, you will never find the minutest idea or hint or implication of any of the followers of Jesus Christ asking for a handout from Rome in order to help them. That is just totally foreign to the New... In fact, that is contrary to everything in the New Testament. The concept of the New Testament is that believers are to support the work of the Lord and nobody else, period. That's it. Categorical. And I don't think anybody can raise a voice against that at all. Number three. We are to express Christian morality and to raise our voices against laws that would be anti-Christian. As per laws forbidding prayer in public places. Imagine somebody telling my kid they couldn't pray in public school. You think that's going to have any effect on my child? I hope it wouldn't. I'd tell my child, go ahead and pray anyhow. See what happens. See what they do to you. As per laws using tax monies for abortion or anti-Christian purposes, we need to raise our voice. Four, we should not expect the state to finance Christian or religious activities of any kind, even ones that call themselves Christians, as per the visit of the Pope to this country. No reason why my tax money should go to some type of support relative to the visit of the Pope, whatever kind of expression that would be, providing an auditorium, whatever. That should be the responsibility of Catholics in this country. If they want the Pope to come, fine. That should be their responsibility. No tax money should go to anything like that. No tax money. No state support to finance Christian activity should be expected, as per the manger scene in Denver. I have never heard so much of a harangue. Do you know what the mayor of the Denver said relative to the manger scene? He says the manger scene is really, our only purpose in this is that it's conducive to business. Yeah, right. All these cars come down in Denver and to see this manger scene, and it creates a lot of traffic and business and merchandising for downtown. It's good for the business of the city. Now, Christians ought to, you know, Christians ought to be up in arms about that. But I never heard anybody say anything about that. We live in a pluralistic society. We should not expect the state or the city to finance a manger scene and put on their property. Now, it is possible that Christians might want to put up a manger scene, and there should be no state law that some portion of the state properties couldn't be used if you're fair to a pluralistic society. See what I'm saying? Which would mean if I don't know what the religious days are of the Hindus, but if on some religious day of the Hindus when they put the charcoal on their head or something like that, and that's a big sacred day, or maybe when they think Muhammad died is a sacred day, and they want to put up and finance and put up a thing, sure. Okay, you go ahead. You grant it. You see what I'm saying? Because we live in a pluralistic society. We should not expect. But see, that's going on so long in Denver that Christians are up in arms because now the manger scene is threatened. Well, state doesn't have any business putting up the manger scene. That's the responsibility of Christians. Point five, and this flows out of point four. We must be consistent and fair in what we expect of the state in view of religious pluralism in our society. Okay? Okay, now I'll tell you how far I'll go with this. One of the most corrupt expressions of what are supposed to be representatives of Christianity that I know of in the United States as a chaplaincy situation in the military. It is an absolute corruptible bureaucratic mess. And I think if good, sound, Bible-believing Christians knew what went on in terms of the chaplains, they would and regurgitate the whole system. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why it's corrupt. You know why it's corrupt? Because it is controlled by a military bureaucracy set up for that purpose. And often, if you are now I happen to belong to a board. I haven't been active in it since probably in the last 10 years, but I was active in it before. I happen to belong to a board that funnels solid Bible-believing fundamental chaplains into the military. You have to have an endorsing agency, and this agency was established just in order to do that. But the reports that come back from those good, solid men are so disturbing. If the bureaucrats decide that all the chaplains need to go through TA, transactional analysis, or the other thing. What's the other thing touching? Sensitivity training. That and encounter experiences. They force these chaplains to go through these encounter experiences. And they'll have retreats like up in Estes Park and the chaplains are forced to go through the encounter. Whether they want to or not, whether they believe it's biblical or not. And I want to tell you something, if they resist those kind of orders, they are really in trouble. And they feel it deeply. I have a friend that resisted one of those. You know what he did? Know what they did to him? He became the chaplain of the base prison because he wouldn't go to an encounter session. There are all forms of manipulation and control whenever you have a setup like the military chaplaincy system as we have. It's open to all kind of abuses and evils. Now, let me suggest something. Let's do away with it. Let's take all these men off the payroll and throw them out of the military. All of them. I don't care what religion they are. Throw them all out. Then it becomes a responsibility. Then set up a system, you see, where Every religion that wants to evangelize or get their message across the military, they send. They pay the way. They pay the freight. They send missionaries to the military. And they have buildings that are conducive to meetings. And these buildings are just open meeting buildings. That's what the chapels are anyhow, you see, in the military. They're all very similar. Sometimes you have enough buildings you can have a Catholic meeting here and a Jewish meeting here and so on. I'm not worried about that part of it. I'm worried about the control and the abuse on the system that we have. What I'm saying is, we must be consistent and fair in what we are to expect of the state in view of religious pluralism in our society. And we should not ask the state for 1 cent of promotion for Christianity. It's just wrong for us to do it. And it would be totally contrary to anything that the apostles taught and everything that Jesus taught in the New Testament. I'm done. Are there any questions, any feedback that we can beat around? You can watch, you can anticipate more and more that under the concept of separation in church and state, greater and greater efforts to totally separate the state from God and any influence of God in the state. You can expect that to be happening in this country. And what we have to do as Christians is to fight that without forcing the state to implement Christianity. And I see our greatest battle in the area of morals. Because the more that the state gets separated from any concept of God, the more becomes the gulf between what is moral and what is immoral. See what I'm saying? I see our great battle in the area of morals. And I want to tell you, we're going to have to raise our voices in those areas more and more in the future. Question?
A couple of areas that are going to kind of in the future now. One of these tax evasion groups that are organizing themselves, calling themselves churches.
Yeah.
They, you know, everybody pays into the church that can be deducted.
Yeah.
By applying what you just said, it looks like in the future that groups like that are going to force the government to find religion. You know, where are we going to stand in that aspect?
I don't know so much that will be the issue as will be the issue of taxation. In other words, will they work on that area of religion or will they work on the area of taxation? I think they'll choose the other because they got a lot of pressure in that direction anyhow. See what I'm saying? It would depend, in answer to your question, I guess it would depend upon what kind of definition they came up with and did it cover the bases. I think that would be the issue you'd have to deal with. The other side of the coin in terms of taxation is another issue. And as far as I'm concerned, I feel that the physical properties of a church should be taxed myself. I don't think you should. I see no reason why the members of this community should have to pay our freight for the sewage lines and so on in the street. I think we ought to pay our own freight. And the only problem that you have there in terms of taxation is if whatever is done has to be done fairly. It has to be done to everybody across the board fairly. You can't cater to one group.
Now,
I understand. I understand. What Tim is bringing up is a valid issue that people in terms of tax evasion are claiming all you have to do is join the group and they make you a minister in the group. And that entitles you to certain tax privileges. And we may lose those. For instance, I have tax privileges on my house that none of you have. It's a matter of courtesy and generosity of the government relative to pastors, because all pastors are social cases anyhow. They just don't make enough money. So it may be that we're going to lose those. And the government in that case is right. They're right. I'll tell you how this is abused. All right, I'll get to your question in a minute. I'll tell you how this is abused. You know, Denver at one time had a situation where you could play on the city golf courses if you were a pastor for 50 cents. And I went down to John F. Kennedy Golf Course one day to play, and I said, "Hey, you have this still have that thing where you can pastors can play for 50 cents?" He says, "You live in Denver?" I said, "No, I don't live in Denver." He says, "Where do you live?" I said, "I live in Aurora." He says, "No, you got to pay the full thing." And I had a guy from out of state with me, and the guy from out of state could play golf cheaper than I could. And I says, "What happened to the thing with pastors? Used to be the whole area." He says, "Listen," he says, we had one church that I swear in 1 week we had 300 people down here, and they were all pastors of this church." And he says, "So, hey, we did away with it." I said, "Hey, I'm with you." Right. That's just an illustration. And what Tim is saying is this is happening nationally. And Church of Scientology, of course, I'm not sure that they're in that same category, but they're close to it.
What I'm thinking
of, the Enterprise like an empire. Yeah. Well, they have wait a minute. We've got to clarify. Pastors pay income tax. There's other tax benefits. But I have seen ads in paper. "We will ordain you. We will send you an ordination thing, and this will entitle you to certain tax benefits. We are a recognized church. Write in, send $15, and we'll see that you get the paper back, and we'll also list the tax benefits." Yes. Okay, Art? Yeah.
I think we're going to see within a few years that the holiday of Christmas.
In terms of work situation. Mm-hmm. Or I see a conflict right away of interest in the state, in that you got an awful lot of people, Jewish people, for example, who don't believe in Christmas, but they get the day off for Christmas. There's a little conflict of interest in some of them. Yeah. Well, I think that anything that the American Civil Liberties Union is taking the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, and they are pushing it to the nth degree. And that's where they're headed. They are headed towards secular statism. You see? You see my point in bringing that first, approaching you on this point. That's, you can watch for the trends in the American Civil Liberty Union toward that direction. Now, at the same time, you may, because of the immoral situation, you will find Christians proffering a solution to the problem over the other way, theocracy. They're wrong. It won't work. And I know some in influential positions that are now pushing that direction. But be careful. Stick with the moral issues, the Christian morality. Yes? You mean in terms of allowing the total amount that's going to the Christian schools as a tax write-off, which is not a law now. Certain schools have certain ways of handling that where a lot of it can be written off. Certain states are, I don't want to take state. Yeah, certain states are more, I don't have any problem with it if it's administered fairly to everybody, equally to everybody. I do have problems with the physical properties as being a tax write-off. In other words, you'll have a church and you'll have enormous holdings in physical properties, millions of dollars worth of buildings. And they're all, and the community is taking on the burden of some of the liabilities of the church, as far as I see it, to the community. Sewer lines, water lines, and so on. I see that as not fair. Unjust. I feel that on physical properties we should all be paying taxes. And I realize that would be a terrible encumbrance on Christian schools. And you must realize that I have been involved in Christian schools personally as a livelihood until I came to Holly Hills Church. Some 13 years or something like that. Colorado. I know some of the problems that would create. Nevertheless, I feel that's a responsibility they have. So I see nothing wrong with a tax write-off if it's a fair, it's fairly administrated to everybody. Was there a question? Yeah, unfortunately, yes. Yeah, you'd have to read the legislation. You have to read it all and see. You have to take them on an individual piecemeal basis and see what it says and try to understand it and then make a decision on it. You see, in the secular society, the way that the state has managed to be so manipulative and control in a control agency is that they have slowly taken the rights away from the majority of the citizens in several ways, and one of the ways is to divorce the parents from influence over their children. That's one way. Another way is to so emphasize the rights of the minority that the rights of the majority often become abused. Now, I'll grant that in a pluralistic society, that's always a struggle, but yet in the societies that have become secularized, I'm talking about socialistic or communist societies, that is two of the means that it's been done. So if we have legislation that begins to threaten the family, then we have to oppose that. And then if we have positive legislation, which Carol was bringing up, then we ought to express our support of that. And we're going to have to do more of that, is what I'm saying. We can't afford to just sort of piecemeal sit back. Yes? Well, this is a basic argument of those who have children in parochial schools, that they're double tax, it's a form of double taxation. But that is not what I was speaking to. What I was speaking to was the responsibility of the school. The responsibility of the school to pay taxes for physical properties, I feel, is a viable. In other words, the school should be responsible. The owners of the school should be responsible. The owners of this church, in a sense, should be responsible. We don't have that law now, but as far as I'm concerned, I would consider that a fair law. But you should be allowed, as far as I see it, a tax write-off for what you give to those schools. And as long as that was administered fairly, everybody who did that. That was the question there. Do you understand the difference?
Well,
it's
just that we are involved
in physical. Yeah. Yeah, what Alicia is bringing up is the fact they don't get a tax write-off, but maybe it balances out because the school physical property is not taxed. I don't know. Whatever we do in a pluralistic society must be fair. Now, that's a Christian attitude. See what I'm saying? And the struggle is going to continue because of pluralism and because of an essential principle, freedom of volitional response to conscience, and it's very critical that we protect it. Okay, yes.
And Ian, you want to be fair, but what do you do when you culpably express it beyond the bounds of what we consider moral or whatever, like Jonestown?
Well, that's
the Unification Church apparently hoarding arms that the churches are doing right now. They're almost appearing to be a threat to the state. Something like that can almost make you want the secular statism to restrict dangerous groups like that.
In a case where you have a danger to society, you do have to restrict it. A physical, tangible, provable danger to society. You do have to restrict it.
Yeah, but the problem is, how are you going to define when it becomes dangerous?
Well, I think it could have been defined in the case of the Jonesville thing. Well, you would have to have somebody investigate and have, and that was supposed to be what was happening. They had been warned, and you'd have to have the objective evidence, and you'd have to bring the objective evidence to court.
Well, obviously, they already have, I guess, the CIA was already investigating.
No, I don't think it was a CIA. There was a congressional investigation that went down, and that's when that Ryan got shot from California. Was it Ryan? I think that's right. Congressman Ryan got killed. But they had enough evidence long before that. They had evidence while they were still in California. I think what we're saying is that there are some elements of struggle, and you have to expect that in terms of human relations, in terms of state, human relations to the state, when you have a sinful society. You have to expect that. But that's part of our struggle, is what I'm saying, as Christians. Okay? Okay, question.
When you say secular statism, does that mean the parents cannot
Well, I on the overhead, I projected a very real and current manifestation of secular statism, which is China. And under that case, the answer is no, they cannot. By law, they are not allowed to teach their children religion. Now, whether or not they do it is another issue. But the law says that, and they can be prosecuted if they do it. You see what I'm saying? Good. Enjoy your response. Yes, John. Los Angeles. Get their permit to do it. I don't have a number or anything on it. It's in the City Department of Building and Safety. I don't know. Don't know the details. I know the details. Let me tell you. It's getting late. Let me just tell you the details in terms of fairness. You know what the school board in Texas, why they ruled against the Gideons? They said, if we rule for them, that means we have to be fair and allow every other group that wants to pass literature out into the schools. Does that sound fair to you? Okay, that sounds fair in a pluralistic society. Sounds fair to me. Okay, let's say, okay, well, I would be willing to do that. Let's let them all go. Okay, let's say you had a child in the sixth or seventh grade, and he came home with the literature from the hairless Christians. And he says, oh, this hairless Krishna was witnessing to me today. Oh, where was he witnessing? Well, at school. At school! You got this. Would you respond that way as a Christian? That's a problem, isn't it? That's a problem for me. I just came across that this week, and I said, I don't know. Let me try to think through this thing. And that's where I am. I'm saying, okay, if you're going to let them pass it out, in a pluralistic society, you have to let everybody pass it out if they want to. Well, then how would they respond if my kids got it in their hand? Well, maybe it would be good. Maybe we Christians would have to say, hey, here's why we rationally reject that. See? Objectively. Here's what's wrong with it. Number one, this is wrong with it. See that? What that says there? That's wrong. That's against the Bible. This is wrong. See? We'd have to maybe be more aggressive. Maybe it would be good. But the principle of fairness applies across the board. Yes? I'm not sure. I don't remember that. I've often thought of that in terms of this platform. And sort of my concept was, we don't want to provide a forum for that. Our forum here is for the positive proclamation of Christianity. But it might be an opportunity for us to have to sit down and say, hey, here's what's wrong with that. You know what I mean? Be forced to do it. We kind of have a captive audience here. But maybe it would do us good to be, you know, forced in those situations. Well, I hope this is helpful. I've enjoyed your feedback and responses, which says, hey, yeah, we are interacting with this, and we will have to interact more in the future. And if you get any articles on this that you feel is good, particularly this continual pushing of separation of church and state, I'm very much interested in. I've had a file on it for ages, and I'm a strong believer in what the Constitution says. I think it's a very healthy thing, and I think what they meant when they wrote the Constitution is very, very good. Very, very, very healthy. It's one of the things that made the church stand on its own two feet in the United States. And the church in the United States is healthier than it is anywhere in the world. Guaranteed. Shall we close in prayer? Thank you, Father, for this provocative time. Again, in the affairs of human relations, what is the role of the righteous or justified man to society? What is his responsibility? As we struggle with this, we pray for light and wisdom from your word and from your spirit, and courage and conviction to make known our thoughts and to make sure that we can substantiate it in your word. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.